Professor James Heckman is a Nobel laureate in economics and professor of economics at the University of Chicago. He speaks candidly with UNICEF's Innocenti Research Center on the compelling evidence in support of early childhood development, the need to break out of developmental silos and look at the life cycle, and why the MDGs must be amended.
Professor, what does the evidence say about the importance of investing in early childhood?
The evidence on the biology, the psychology, the economics all points to the importance of early stimulation, early investment in childhood. That said, there's still a range of questions that need to be addressed. Exactly which programs are the best programs? Which programs essentially target at different levels of disadvantage? So we need to understand better the trade-off, how much an intervention of one type compensates for and supplements the intervention in another type. How much do we really need to spend on nutrition as opposed to cognitive stimulation? The details there remain to be worked out. We haven't really addressed that in a way that needs to be carefully implemented for policy. But the contours are there. We know that these early interventions play a very strong, a positive role in promoting child development. But exactly which interventions for which countries and for which family situations still remains to be developed.
There is no mention of ECD in the MDGs. Was that a mistake? And how should ECD be included in a post-MDG world?
Well, when the Millennium Development Goals were originally constructed, the level of knowledge about the life cycle of human development was not at what it is today. We've learned a lot in the last decade from research in anthropology, from biology, in economics, in sociology, education. A lot of work has come together that's shown the importance of early years and the dynamics of human skill formation. So I'll give you an example. The Millennium Development Goals were heavily influenced by work, earlier work, by Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum. They talked about what's called the capability approach. And the capability approach is an approach that tries to imagine improving the welfare of children and adults, people, without differentiating as to age, by giving them, empowering them to perform and succeed in economic and social settings in very broad environments. Those Millennium Development Goals are very well established, but in using a theory, using a framework that really did not take into account how the capabilities were formed. And what we've done in the last 10, 11 years is create knowledge of how to construct and create capabilities. So that instead of thinking of capabilities as some kind of static endowment, say political freedom or level of education, we've come to understand how the early years, even the adolescent years and throughout the whole lifetime, how we can put together the whole person, how we can essentially think about the structure of the life cycle, how we can essentially promote capabilities by developing policies that develop the synergy. So one of the basic findings, which is reported in the Lancet article, and it summarizes a lot of work in the last decade or so, some of which I've contributed to, but others, many others, as noted in the Lancet article, have as well, is that early investment, early stimulation, early strategies can essentially reduce the cost of later strategies. But the key new concept that I don't think was present in the Millennium Development Goals was a sense of how the outcomes at one age were linked to the outcomes at an earlier age. And therefore, it had this kind of atemporal, static, didn't look at the life cycle. It was basically it was a notion of entitlement, but without a mechanism for producing the capabilities to which, I think it said in many ways properly, were the right goals, which the capabilities, the empowerment of individuals. So I think we've understood the mechanisms much more. I don't know if there is such a thing as a post-MDG world, but I would say that as we evolve into the next decade, this decade, we round that out and go on to the next decade, we will have a deeper appreciation for where in the life cycle and with what interventions and for which groups we can target and make effective interventions. And I think that's, it's just change. What's changed is that we understand now much better how people are formed. But we know that capabilities evolve, that previous strategies feed into the later outcomes, that previous activities play a very important role. As we understand that, we actually now understand much better than before how to create the capabilities. And so that's the new development. And I think this is what's made this body of work in child development very important and part of even a larger project, which is understanding and prioritizing how to build skills over the whole life cycle. And this is the major development that comes and is summarized well in the Lancet articles, how the early years create the foundations for everything that comes afterward. And that if we actually invest early, get the base right, we get something which is dynamic and synergistic. It means that people who start off on the right track stay on the right track. I've heard the term sometimes described as the Matthew effect. I mean, this is a term. It's basically saying if you give and you endow people with certain capabilities early on, they simply keep creating those capabilities and they become even more productive over time. Whether you want to call it the Matthew effect or what other name, synergy, dynamic complementarity, lots of different names are given to it. But it comes to the same thing, that an early start is very helpful in creating later capability, functioning, even learning in school. So what we've learned is the sooner you invest, the better. The later remedial investments tend to be much less efficient. And the body of evidence grows, it continues to grow, and it points to a timing. This doesn't mean, by the way, that you should shut everything down after the kid finishes preschool. Schooling, later life training, all of these things matter, but we've got to get children, all children, onto the right trajectory so they can take advantage of all the opportunities that they will have as they go downstream, as they go into life, and they become adults. And the Millennium Development Goals simply didn't recognize this dynamic. Now I think we do, and so they should be amended. They should at least recognize this dynamic. Now you ask, do we know about what the best policies should be? Well, I think we're in the middle of trying to learn those policies and trying to develop the evidence for them. I think that we know that certain programs, traditional programs that have largely been put in place in advanced countries, have been very effective. We have long-term evaluations evaluated by methods of randomized trials that suggest that the annual rate of return, the return per dollar or per pound or per euro invested in each child, is 7 to 10% per annum. So in terms of a passbook savings account, especially with interest rates being what they are now, that's a very, very good return, much higher than what you would get in stocks even before the meltdown occurred. So there really is a structure of evidence that shows that these early investments can be very powerful, especially if they're targeted to the most disadvantaged. I think that's very well established. The evidence is very strong that there are programs that can work. But is the evidence enough to just stop? Should we just stop collecting the evidence? No. What we need to do, especially in low and middle income countries, is build even a stronger database than currently exists, with long-term follow-up, with interventions that understand the link between health, education, cognition, and social skills, all of which interrelate and produce capable people in the adult years. And I think in that sense, we're still at the early stages in trying to learn how to craft and put together these structures. So I'm very strongly supportive of further research. I'm an academic. I guess that's kind of stereotypical. On the other hand, in this situation, in this case, in this particular problem, even though the contours are well known, we really need to drill down. And I think we need to sift the evidence more strongly than we do, even than Lancet does. I mean, Lancet puts together a lot of facts, but it doesn't have an analytical framework. We've developed one here. We've tried to put things together, but there's still a lot of holes in the factual base for that framework. What we call the technology of skill formation essentially tells us how the early years feed into the skills that lead to success in the later years. And so we have the contours, as I say, correct. We have to integrate to that body of evidence the importance of early health. And that's being done now. And then we can understand better how the general capability formation process works. But even more, we need to understand how specific programs work. And now we're in a stage where there are many different proposals out there, and we can't honestly argue that there's a single best way, not based on the given evidence. We know there are good ways, but there's a lot more to be done. The second point, the second question you asked me was, how strong is the evidence that investing is not an expenditure for a nation, but an opportunity to accrue income over the longer term? Well, almost by definition, an investment, at least an investment with a positive payoff, has income returned from it over the longer term. I think we have to understand the difference between a transfer, which dominates a lot of thinking in the U.S., the U.K., and many countries around the world, the benefits of transfer programs from the benefits of investment programs. So when we invest in the education and the well-being and the capabilities of a young child, we actually are creating a return that society and the individual, as part of the society, but also the individual in terms of his or her own earnings, actually creates for the child. So you actually will get a return, and I think it's important that we realize that some expenditures, like, for example, here's an example. If we give a lot of money to older people to take care of their retirement, you can argue on that and say it's socially fair that in many ways, especially pensioners paid into a Social Security system, that they maybe are entitled to that as part of a promise made to them. Perhaps we can think about expending much money on the health of older people. I'm not saying that's wrong, but I'm saying that the rate of return in terms of producing an investment for that will actually pay off is going to be much lower. I mean, it'll have some effect. There might be some return. But if you prioritize and you ask, well, what's the rate of return on this compared to the rate of return for the kinds of programs that are early childhood development programs are aimed at, we get much higher returns for the latter. And the reason is that we're producing more productive people, producing more output for society, and at the same time, and this is very important to understand, we are reducing inequality. But there is a trade. There is no trade-off for early childhood investment in the following sense, that we can simultaneously boost productivity, make children in the next generation more accomplished and capable adults, and reduce inequality in the larger population. That, I think, is a particularly important feature of this investment. So it's an investment, and like a transfer, it also helps reduce inequality. But unlike many other transfers, it has a positive output capital, human capital producing aspect to it. People have asked, how can we convince governments about this kind of policy of investing in early children? Well, first of all, I would qualify the question by saying we don't want to just convince governments. We want to convince the people that the governments represent and the other private sector groups that interact with governments. We want to convince philanthropists. We want to convince organizations within the society to essentially recognize the importance of the early years and investments and the value of investments. We need to understand that these investments have high payoffs. And the way we can do it is just letting the facts speak for themselves. Long-term evaluations with rigorous evaluation, randomized trials, random assignment, the structure being set where we have a fundamental capability set created, where we actually produce these things. We can rigorously evaluate these things. We can compare, for example, a policy of building an airport to a policy of investing in children who are disadvantaged or children who are advantaged. What has fallen out of favor in academic public finance and in a lot of government policy evaluation is a simple calculation of what's called a rate of return. How effective are these? So even if we ignore the whole issue of equity and social justice, we can find that these investments, when suitably evaluated, and I mean rigorously evaluated, not evaluated in a way that gives me an answer or an answer that people like, but one that really survives, will produce rates of return much higher for most of the social programs that governments are engaged in supporting. And when you add to that, that the government can leverage its resources by bringing in the private sector and taking the private sector in. This is very important. Why? For two reasons. Governments are very short on cash, whether it's in Malawi or UK or in the United States or Australia, everywhere around the world, governments are under strain because the economies are under strain. The tax base has been diminished. But what we can do is leverage these investments, and we can understand that bringing in private sources not only creates money, gives funds to support this, but at the same time, it brings in diverse points of view. And that's because there isn't a single best program, and that these programs do intervene in the early lives of children. And because they intervene early in the lives of children, they essentially are playing in part, or at least supplementing the part played by parents. These programs have to recognize that the early years are very decisive, and not just in shaping IQ and not just in shaping health, but also in terms of shaping values. And because there's some disagreement about what those values should be, the program should be diverse, and they should bring in diverse elements in their design and implementation. That raises money, it respects diversity in the larger society, and essentially creates a society that I think is more effective, and program that is more likely to be broadly supported. Is a radical change needed? I think the radical change is what people at the World Bank and other places have called the need to end silos. And what I mean by this is the following. We're talking about human development. Human development has many features, many aspects. It includes the development of cognition, how smart you are, how well you read, how well you solve math problems. It also involves social skills. So what we need to understand is that traditional cabinet-level bifurcations or trifurcations or separations where one group looks at health, one group looks at education, one group looks at nutrition, another group looks at crime, and so forth, we really should have departments and interventions that look at how human capital is formed. So we need departments of human capital, departments that essentially raise the level of skills and recognize the synergies, the complementarity, the fact that one activity absolutely stimulates the other activity in building a creative, functioning human being. And I think the radical change that's needed is to break down the traditional disciplinary barriers.